We have to wait on God to be God. And this is my concern for our churches, is that we get too caught up in process and method.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Bob Cornwall. He's a Disciples of Christ minister and the author of a number of books, including his most recent one that we'll be talking about, Called to Bless, Finding Hope by Reclaiming Our Spiritual Roots. Additionally, Bob is a reviewer of books. He writes them regularly, pretty much every single week. We'll be talking about that practice of reading and writing about books as well in this conversation. You can find his book reviews at bobcornwall.com, but you can also now find them at wordandway.org. Each week, you'll find a review from Bob, as well as a number of other things, news articles, columns by many of our contributing writers, guest columns, and much more. So be sure to check us out at wordandway.org. Now, here's my conversation with Bob Cornwall, author of Called to Bless. Well, Bob, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, I'm excited to have this conversation on a number of fronts, and we'll be talking about, you know, some of your writing that you've been doing that we've been publishing at Word and Way. But before we get there, I first want to talk about your new book, Called to Bless, Finding Hope by Reclaiming Our Spiritual Roots. And that subtitle gives people a little bit of a hint. We're talking about spiritual roots. You also talk about a spiritual DNA in the book. So I wonder, you set the stage. What is it that you were trying to do in this work?
So the book has its origins in a sabbatical I took in 2013 from my church. And the theme that we were working with was reclaiming our founding vision. So that's kind of where it started. And personally, I began to look at my own life story and my rather peripatetic background of moving, of being born Episcopalian, spending my a good portion of high school and college years in Foursquare, which is a Pentecostal denomination. I went to Fuller Seminary, which is multi-denominational. And while there, I was part of an evangelical covenant church and ended up Disciples, which is the denomination of which I was ordained and am currently ordained and withstanding in my current state as retired. So part of it was simply looking at my own background and recognizing that all of these places I've been in my journey are part of who I am. And so I asked that question of how do they integrate? How do I integrate them into my own life? And then I began to think in terms of in conversation with my congregation, how does a congregation integrate it, the variety of perspectives that come into the life of the church? And so we had some conversation about that. Plus, what are the founding visions? When the church I served at the time, Central Woodward Christian Church, when it was founded, it goes back to the 1840s, but its major place that we drew our name from was a church in Detroit, which was one of the largest churches in the denomination. It is no longer that. Like many former large churches and influential churches. So, you know, with the congregation, I was asking them to think about how does that founding story influence who we are now? So that's kind of how, so it was kind of a two-pronged thing. And that's what the way I work with it in the book is both my personal story and a church's story, and ask the question of how does our founding visions, our spiritual roots, and then I came up with this idea of spiritual DNA to kind of cover it. How does that influence who we are now?
Yeah. Well, let's unpack that concept a little bit, because it's a really important idea, this sense of
I mean, you're talking about a church. Let's talk the church that you write about, you know, 1840. I mean, no one today was around when the church was founded.
Right.
And so, like, on the one hand, it'd be easy to be like, well, you know, regardless what happened back then, like, that's not us. And, you know, how much does that really impact us? And so, you know, why is it important? How is it helpful for churches, for individuals to reflect back on, you know, what led them to this point?
So my answer, I guess, in that, and I think that would be personal too, but is a question of identity. You know, who are we and why are we? You know, why the church that is the centerpiece of my conversation in the book is a church that was born and planted in Detroit, had a couple of different locations over the decades, but was a church in Detroit, and it was a fixture in Detroit at a certain point in time. And then in the late 70s, as the congregation, as the city of Detroit changed and the congregation members largely moved to the suburbs, the church finally decided that to follow its people and moved and just moved into the suburbs in a way that they kind of went looking for a space to be with a congregation that was from all over the place. In Metro Detroit. Metro Detroit is a rather unwieldy region. If you've ever been here, you know how wide. I mean, the city of Detroit itself is 134 square miles. And then you add in the three counties of Metro Detroit, three or four counties of Metro Detroit, and that becomes even more complicated. But that's kind of, you know, the journey that congregation has had to wrestle with, is how does its current situation relate to where it was? Because, in truth be told, they never changed their name. So they have a name that reflects nothing about where they are today in terms of location. They're not on Woodward Avenue anymore. And the question of whether they're central is a whole nother another issue. But you know how it is. But it's not unusual. Congregations have been doing this. I mean, First Baptist Church of Detroit's in Southfield. So,
yeah, that's good. We've got a church not too far from us. That's Baptist Church of Nashville. That's Missouri, and the city doesn't even exist anymore, but the church still does, right? So,
right.
It's just, now it's a real church.
It's hard to let go, but part of that is, how does that reflect? Why can't we let go? I mean, why over 40 years was this church resistant or unable or unwilling or didn't think it was important to let go of their name? So, I mean, that was part of our conversation as a church, which led me to, you know, to having broader conversations about, you know, who we are. And because we kind of, I think, my sense in my experience, put it that way, especially with mainline Protestant churches, is we tend to chase the shiny red ball, whatever's working at that time, and forget who we were and ask the question of, does that have anything to do with who we are now?
You very briefly mentioned, you walk through this more in the book, your own personal journey as well, right? So you got the church, and right. You got your own. Let's start with where you ended up, or I mean, I don't want to suggest that you ended, but where you are and where you have been for your ministry in Christian Church Disciples of Christ. And then we'll walk backwards. But first of all, you know, why don't you introduce us to that denomination for listeners that may not be as familiar? I'm sure they've seen the signs in their own town, but you know, who are you and why is this the faith community after all these other ones? Why is that the one that you decided to plant your ministry in?
So the Christian Church Disciples of Christ is an American-born denomination, born on the American frontier, which at the time was Western Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and Ohio, and had this. The founders were for the most part Presbyterians, who found that the Presbyterian churches that they were part of were limited what they could do in terms of their ministry, and began to look at the idea of unity. Of, you know, if we could only unify the churches and the Christian faith communities, then we could be better equipped to evangelize. And on the frontier where, you know, people are moving and you've got 50,000 churches, not that much, but you've got, I'll just name one person, Thomas Campbell, who, when he got his start in the United States, he was part of a Scottish Presbyterian group. And he came over here and he got himself in trouble because he invited other Presbyterians of other branches, other denominations, not of his own, to come to the table. And he was defrocked because of that. And so he decided, you know, maybe there's a better way here, and we'll pursue a movement of unity. You know, it didn't quite work the way he had anticipated, but that's kind of the DNA of who the disciples are. And then in terms of my journey, I kind of landed in the disciples. I went to what is now Bushnell University, but at the time was Northwest Christian College in Eugene, Oregon, which is a disciples related school. When I went there, I didn't even know who the disciples were, but I learned and eventually decided that, having been Episcopalian, disciple, covenant, hanging out with some other folks, that this disciple ethos seemed to fit who I am. So why am I a disciple? It's because I'm a crazy person and I need a place that allows crazy people who bring a lot of different disjointed religious traditions in their life into one place, because it's ecumenical, right? So that's who I am. And I've been preaching at a Presbyterian church in retirement. So, you know, that's who I am. So disciples seem to fit me well.
I mean, I'm not sure if the denomination is ready to use that as like the tagline for, you know, an ad of like, I'm a disciple because I'm a crazy person. But, you know, in context, it's a good description of, but this idea of being ecumenical, which you write about in the book as part of your spiritual DNA, and you talk through the how that's embedded in this denominational identity and the impact it's had on you. But I mean, that idea of being ecumenical is really important to disciples and to you. And so I wonder if you can talk about that, because I mean, you alluded to one little story, and you know, we get these crazy stories in our various traditions, right? This Presbyterian can't join this Presbyterian for communion. I mean, you know, it's like, how do we get in these little lines that we're dividing ourselves so much, even at the table? So I wonder if you can talk about how ecumenicalism has impacted your faith on this journey.
So much of my ministry, I have been ordained now 37 years in June, so I'm creeping up on that. Most of my life, my ministry has been in communities where there's not, you know, the closest disciple church might be 40, 50 miles away. And so my life and my ministry has been largely ecumenical. And then over time became, especially since I've been here in Troy, become increasingly interfaith in terms of the outreach. So tomorrow night, I was asked by the mayor of our city to lead an invocation. But then Ethan asked, it would be really great if we could do this in an interfaith manner. So him knowing that I have a group of friends, I was able to put us together. So we are having an interfaith prayer tomorrow night to open the city, a state of the city address that will be Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, and Christian. And so that's who I am. And it became increasingly so. Disciples are a small denomination, and we kind of spread around us. So I've just gravitated towards being ecumenical, it just kind of reinforced who I was from my origins, it appears.
of course, you know, this idea of thinking about DNA, and you start the book by, you know, thinking about biological DNA, right, and tracing ancestry and so forth. But right. when you frame this journey as a DNA question, then all of these other traditions that you were a part of, Episcopalian, Foursquare, you know, so on along the way, it's not that you have just, you know, moved on and put that behind, like you can't completely shake it. It's still part of your DNA. Just like I may not have met my great, great, great grandmother, but she's still part of my DNA. And so right. I wonder if you can talk about, you know, what, even though you've moved on from those traditions, you know, how have they still continued to shape who you are?
Right. So another book that I published is called Unfettered Spirit, which is a book on spiritual gifts, reflects my Pentecostal background to an extent. And there's a funny story. So when I was, I asked Amos Young, who's at Fuller now, but I had invited him to come and speak at our church. And he's a Pentecostal theologian. And so I was driving, he had read the manuscript of the book, and I was driving him to the airport. And I said, you know, as an ex-Pentecostal or something. And Amos said to me, and basically these almost word for word, he said, why do you keep on using the word ex-Pentecostal or ex-charismatic? He said, just own it. Just own it. And that made sense, you know, to me. I mean, finally, it's like, yeah, that's who I am. That's why I wrote this book in its origin, and had been writing it for years, because it reflects a portion of who I am. And then there was another similar story, different story, but when I was doing my sabbatical, I was in Oxford. And my PhD is in English church history, focusing on high church Anglican ecclesiology. So that kind of reflects who I am too, you know. So anyway, I'm in the Christ Church Cathedral there in Oxford at Evensong, and I get this feeling. And so I kind of like, it touched my inner Anglican came out in that moment. And I recognized, yeah, that's who I am. So all of these pieces contribute to who I am, how I understand the church, how I understand my ministry. And so they're components to this DNA of who I am. And I believe congregations reflect the DNA of the people that, I mean, even if you're a denomination, whatever your denomination is, it reflects the components, the denominational components, but also the components that each of these members bring into the mix. And so the question is, how do you integrate that? Because, you know, if I'm going to a Presbyterian church, for instance, and I'm a disciple, do I have to abandon everything that is disciple in me? Or can I bring that into the life of the congregation? And so that's the question that we all ask. And in this day and age, as congregations become more and more, fewer and fewer members of our congregations are lifetime members of that congregation and of that denomination. So, you know, how do we incorporate this diversity into our lives as a church and as an individuals?
So, I mean, obviously, you know, you're ecumenical, and yet at the same time, you are ordained in a tradition. Right. And you're just now making this comment about how, you know, we don't have the denominational brand loyalty we used to have. I mean, some people like to say we're in a post-denominational era, but I mean, do you still see a place then for denominations and for churches being affiliated in this era?
Yeah, in the sense that denominations provide a focal point of a distinctiveness about the faith tradition. the key is not to hold, is the key would be to hold that a bit looser than maybe we have in the past, so that disciples can hold on to that which is important and provide a beacon for that. So, you know, people are looking for something like that, can go there. You know, if you're Presbyterian, we know that a lot of folks are gravitating towards Orthodoxy, because it meets a need. So we find ourselves, I think that think of it in terms of brands, the brands are valuable as long as they don't become exclusive and preventing relationships to exist. The problem that we face denominationally, and I should share this, but I'm, besides preaching at a Presbyterian church, I'm the co-chair of a dialogue between the disciples and the ELCA, Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, which are very different churches. And so the question is full communion possible? And, you know, one of the issues that, so part of that has to do with the table. So I'm welcome at an ELCA table, but I can't preside at an ELCA table. But an ELCA pastor can preside at a disciple table. So the question is, you know, how does that work? And it becomes, we had this conversation, I was at we did our meeting recently, and, you know, the disciples in the room, mainly me and one other, got real emotional about this conversation, you know, and part of that had to do with, I've been preaching at a Presbyterian church, and I can preach, but I can't preside at the table. So these are questions that we have to wrestle with. So there are still challenges there, and they probably will remain there for a long time. I believe that denominations provide DNA. But we have to hold them, but they get mixed in our ecumenical conversations and relationships.
Well, as you've already noted, I mean, this is not your first book. You've written a number of other books, but you also read a lot of books and you write about reading a lot of books a lot of times. So, I mean, you've been reviewing books regularly. I mean, you know, essentially weekly, you know, most weeks for years on your blog, bobcornwall.com. You call it Ponderings on a Faith Journey. More recently, we've been republishing your weekly book reviews at wordandway.org, so people can find those there as well. And we're grateful to be able to, you know, to provide those for more people to see. I want to talk about this idea of reading and writing about the books. But first of all, I mean, where do you find the time?
That's a good question. I'm an addict.
My name's Brian. I am also addicted to reading books. So, you know,
yeah,
take space here.
Yeah. So I have a book. I usually have a book in most rooms of the house. And partly because of the blog, but partly because I also edit a journal for the Academy of Parish Clergy. I've developed relationships with publishers who are willing to feed my habit. So they continually send me free books, and I feel obligated to, number one, read them, and number two, to review them so that they will continue to feed my habit, which so far they've been willing to do.
That's good. You got to pay your dealers. So, you know.
That's right. That's right.
We'll pay them for a review. So, well, let's talk a little bit about this idea of reading then. I mean, obviously you enjoy it, but, you know, reading is generally down in our society, right? People don't read as much as they used to. I mean, as someone who spends my life writing, is really discouraging statistics about, you know, the percentage of Americans that don't read anything after they, you know, get out of school, right? And so, you know, what is it about reading? how does that shape you? And let's think this particularly, you know, from a faith journey perspective, why is it important for Christians to be reading in general?
You know, and I have to confess, a number of books have been written about, you know, preachers, what that preachers should be readers, which I agree. I am not as diverse a reader as I should be. I tend to overread nonfiction and underread fiction.
Yeah, my wife says the same thing about me all the time. So I get it.
You know, so I'm not as well-read as I should be. However, you know, and it doesn't really matter how you read. I mean, you know, in terms of, you don't have to read 120 books a year like I do as my addiction. But if we're not reading, we're missing out on information, but also just nourishment in our lives. We become defined by what's momentary. Because a book, if you think in terms of a book, normally a book takes, you know, so the author writes the book and gets it edited and gets it published. And so Ron Allen and I just completed the manuscript of a book that will get published. So we've submitted the manuscript and it'll get published sometime next spring, maybe. So there's usually a year between the time you submit the book to the publisher and when it comes out. You just kind of think about that a book is something that's taken time and it's not immediate. So it's not like a newspaper. So a newspaper is immediate, or even, you know, on my phone when I, the latest news that comes on my phone every day or every minute, and it updates every time.
Right. I mean, I'm looking at Twitter while we're talking. So, you know.
Right. Yeah. So, we can be immediate, but a book is not immediate. A book requires attention. It requires reflection, and so I think if a book slows us down in our lives. So I think reading in that fashion, whatever the reading can be. I mean, I'd prefer you would read my books. That my publishers would love that if you would read my books. I write I've become a writing addict as well. I write and no one reads my books, but I have to write them. But I think what is true for us is how do we slow down and reflect on realities, and books provide that.
As one who has also written books, and I empathize with you on both the timeline and the selling, I like to borrow the Will Campbell line, and he was being humble, and I can say it honestly that I am the author of rare books. So, you know, welcome to the club. But yeah, so everyone please go buy, you know, my books, buy Bob's books, you know, it'll make us feel better. So, and it's always that's great right. To get that royalty check and be able to actually take the whole family to McDonald's this year. So that's always good.
There we go. That would be helpful.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation, but first I want to remind you that you should subscribe to Warden Way's award-winning e-newsletter, A Public Witness. It will help you make sense of the world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wardenway.org. And now, back to our conversation.
So let's think about this idea of writing a review, because, you know, I mean, we all did book reviews in school, but, you know, there's the art of writing a review. It's harder than it might seem like at first to people, you know. So when you're going to, you know, you've taken this book, I mean, your more recent book, you know, called The Blessed, is actually a short book. It clocks in at 100 pages. But, you know, some of these books that you're reviewing they're a lot longer. And so, and you're trying to distill this down to, you know, several hundred words at most. So, you know, how do you go about the process of writing a review?
So I usually use Goodreads as a way of recording my my reading habits. And I usually will write a preliminary review on Goodreads, and then take that when I get the chance to put it on the blog. Then I'll rewrite it. The Goodreads review is not the same quality, hopefully, as the one that appears on my blog or on Words Away. So reviews are different depending on the context. So when I've reviewed for like Christian Century or Church History or something like that, which are more either a journal or a magazine, they have a little bit more expectation strictures on what I'm supposed to write. When I write for my blog, I can write whatever I want. I'm my own editor. So that's a little bit different. But what I try to do is look for, what I do in the initial paragraph or two is to give a sense of my approach to the book. I mean, why did I read this book? You know, what does it mean to me? Just to kind of to invite the reader into my life in terms of my approach to the book. You know, why am I reading this book? And then I try to walk through the book and to give a good sense of, what is the book about? What are the key elements of that book? And then some critique perhaps at the end. For the most part, I review books that I like. So it's very rare that I would, especially on my blog, if I don't like a book, unless it's Eric Metaxas's book on Dietrich Bonhoeffer, which needs to be told that this whoever Eric Metaxas is, he has not read Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He's portrayed Dietrich Bonhoeffer as someone who no one who's actually read Dietrich Bonhoeffer knows. So maybe there are those kinds of books where become popular that simply need to be slapped down.
Sucker punch.
Yeah, but rarely do I. If I get 20 pages into the book and say, "Oh, I can't read any further," I'm not going to review it, because what I want to do is write reviews of books that I would like you, the reader, to read, unless it's something I don't want you ever to read. So go and, bury it, please. Don't burn it, but.
But yeah, just don't buy it.
Yeah, don't buy it.
Don't buy it.
Please don't buy it. Here are alternative biographies of Bonhoeffer that actually know what they're talking about.
Yeah, well, I guess now Metaxas is not going to sponsor this podcast.
Probably
that's
not.
Okay. No, that's all right. Do not buy any of his books, but that one especially. So there we go. So, obviously it's not as problematic with nonfiction as it is with fiction that you're not going to like spoil the ending.
Right.
So you don't have to worry about that as much as a reviewer. But, what's this line between, I want to give people, the information that makes the book seem interesting and they really will buy it.
Right.
Versus giving them, the details so they no longer actually need to really buy the book because I've given you all the best parts.
Right. So, since I mostly review nonfiction theology books, commentaries, things like that, you're going to get a review of a book that you can then know, what is happening in the book and why this author has value. So the review that went up today was Ron Heifeld's book on called The New Adam, a book on atonement, which he's writing predominantly to evangelicals and also to liberals. And I posted a note on a disciples Facebook group, And someone responded, well, you can't teach evangelicals anything, which is not true. Liberals can not be taught as well. But I said, that's not the point of the book. You know, so basically what Highfield does in the book is review the foundations for why atonement theory evolves and the Protestant embrace of penal substitution. And then that's kind of the evangelical go-to. And liberals have chosen moral influence. And Highfield feels that both of these are dead ends. And then it actually takes us east to Eastern Orthodoxy in terms of the idea of theosis as a better endpoint for this. It's kind of a scholarly book, but it's accessible, and it deals with issues that maybe you know the person in the pew is not necessarily going to find valuable, and yet might be because they've been asking those questions. They've heard this stuff, and then really preachers ought to read it because they could better understand and deal with some of this stuff. But so what I'm trying to do is influence people to read good stuff, good books, and to read theology. You know, I review pastoral ministry stuff and everything. But my love is theology and church history. And I want people to know that this is important and that it will help you with your faith journey. Wherever you are, whether you're a layperson or a clergy or scholar for that matter. Reading is important. And so these are books that I think you might want to read.
So, but why read theology? Why read church history? Why not just read the Bible? Right? Isn't that all we need?
And as a church historian, no. In fact, I argued with some theologians that feel like what we know now is important, so church history is kind of irrelevant. Think in terms of the Bible emerges and it was written 2,000 years ago at the newest portions, right? What's happened in between that time, and how has church history and how has that scripture been read, applied over time? I hang out to some degree with the open and relational folks, and sometimes what I hear a lot, and especially in that group and progressive theology, is that you know Jesus had it right, and then the Greeks got a hold of it and messed everything up. So the question is, if the Greeks had not messed it up, would it ever have gotten transmitted to us? So maybe we do need to go back and ask the question whether they got it right. But if they had not, if Origen and Gregory of Nyssa and Augustine hadn't thought it through and used the philosophical categories of their day to transmit, would we have it? And then my son and I have had this conversation, and he loves church history. And it's like, why do we think that what we know now is any better than what other people have thought in the past? So I think they could be wrong, but let's listen and hear them.
It's almost like it's all the stuff in the past is part of our DNA. I think I've heard that somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's like a Baptist. I know that you have Baptist background. I've hung out with some Baptists.
We're okay sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've been part of a member of a Baptist church. And the disciple, Alexander Campbell, hung out with the Baptist for a while. So we have Baptist DNA and who we are as disciples. But, you know, a lot of Baptists today have become Christian nationalists, which is rather odd considering that the early Baptists in the United States were anything but Christian nationalists. They They were opponents of church-state in relationships in terms of the merger. They would not have flown American flags, I expect, in their churches back then. So, you know, it'd be helpful if Baptists to learn their history.
No, preach it. You go for it. It's like Randall Balmer asked, right? Where have all the Baptists gone?
Yeah.
The question of not knowing our own history, not knowing what's in our DNA.
Right.
Well, you know, as you think about all that you've read, all that you've experienced in ministry, you know, I mean, we live in a time when honestly, it feels like there's a lot of naysayers about the future of the church and, you know, even before COVID, and honestly, you know, COVID has exacerbated and accelerated all of these trends and all of these concerns. So what's your thought moving forward? What do you see for the future of the church, maybe where we are headed, and what do we need to be doing differently to change that trajectory if you think we're on the wrong path?
So did I tell you I'm retired?
Yeah, I know. See, you can say all this stuff now, right? You know, you can. Yeah, you know, I mean, right. I know you're doing like a little temp thing right now, but I can't get you fired. You can just lay it all out now. You know?
Yeah. I guess I could lose my standing, except for I'm the chair of the Commission on Ministry for the region. So,
well, hey, you've got the power.
I got power in that sense. You know, it's been interesting as we had conversation during the height of COVID among clergy about, you know, what is the future? Besides the fact that most of the clergy in my age were retiring as quickly as we could because we were unequipped to do what needed to be done, and decided to let the younger clergy have at it because they seemed to have a better grip on digital media than we old folks did. I did my best, but when I'm the most equipped in my congregation to handle that, then we're in trouble. So, you know, I don't know what the future is going to hold. I mean, a lot of people think that we're going to go to kind of online digital church, and that's the future. That's possible, but I don't know that that's the future. There is church is about people and relationships. And while you can communicate information through media, and it will be helpful to those who cannot be part of the community for whatever reason, you know, it could be because they're shut-ins, and that we've learned some digital media in small congregations, even though what we're using for the most part is a smartphone camera with Facebook Live, and that's or YouTube or whatever platform you choose. But and we're broadcasting that on our Facebook page, let's say, and our congregants can go there, and anybody and other people can do that. But ultimately, I don't know that that's the future. I think we'll find new ways of being church. My guess is that mega churches will eventually give way to smaller communities. Could be house churches, could be just small churches. The churches that I will admit, I've never pastored a large church. I've been a small church pastor the entire time. I dreamed about making it bigger than it ever became, but I never figured out how to do that. But, you know, I think that long term, that's kind of where churches are going to be. They're going to be mostly small. Small churches tend to be resilient. They're less dependent on staff, you know. So I have a feeling that we're going to become more like that, which makes it difficult though for those of us in the profession. Because how do you make a living you can be bivocational, but that's difficult, you know. But that's where a lot of churches are heading with bivocational pastors. But how do you spend, you know, the amount of time and money to train for a profession that's not going to pay you very well. And, you know, I have a nice pension. Had I started the pension fund earlier, I'd probably be even wealthier in retirement. But, you know, I'm doable as a result of that. So, yeah, I don't know. I take the idea seriously that the church's future is not dependent on me. That the spirit, God's spirit, has been through. I mean, we've been at this for over 2,000 years. We've had our ups and downs, but the church continues through all of this. So I don't know what the church is going to look like. It's probably going to look different, but the church will not disappear.
I mean, that's an encouraging message that has come from the perspective of history, right? The way you put it, it's not dependent on me. It's not dependent on you, right? The church has existed long before either one of us showed up. And so, you know, that's a encouraging message, even when things look like they're trending in the wrong direction, as they do in a lot of churches and denominations.
So I just finished reading Andy Root's latest book on, which I'll be reviewing soon, on the crisis of decline. And he brings in that book, he brings into play a story of, it's a fictional story of a church, a small church that's essentially dying and trying to figure out who it is, with Bart, the pastor, and what Bart was learning as a pastor, and that influenced his own sense of theology, influenced by the Blumhearts, who were pietists, but waiting on that the key is waiting, that we have to wait on God to be God. And this is my concern for our churches, is that we get too caught up in process and method. We're looking for the latest gig, something that's going to make, you know, you just plug this in and, you know, the church is going to grow, but it never does that. You can't transplant the greatest thing that you learn from the mega church into a small church, and tomorrow that small church is going to be 10,000 people. Now you hear the story, it's like, well, this so-and-so took this church of 100 and made it 10,000. Well, how'd they do that? Well, they probably were kind of a charismatic personality. It was a personality-driven thing. And those things happen, but then can they sustain themselves? There's a church that existed in Orange County in Garden Grove. That was a national or worldwide church, had a big TV audience, had a crystal palace as a church. It's now a Roman Catholic cathedral because it could not, the succession didn't take place. It, you know, it could maybe a little bit, but over time, and that happened, but Central Woodward Christian Church, the church I serve, back in when Edgar DeWitt Jones was its pastor in the 30s and 40s, had over 2,000 members. Then Perry Gresham came along and kind of continued that on for a bit. But by the 1960s, it had become much smaller. And then when it moved to the suburbs, it was even smaller. And by the time I got there, it was even smaller. And when I retired, it was in COVID, so it was even smaller. And, you know, but that's the way it is. I mean, mega churches have their time and place. Unless you have a cathedral that's, you know, 1,100 years old and finds ways of maintaining itself. But, the majority of people that go to St. Paul's, London, are probably tourists. At least I was when I went there.
Well, excellent. Well, Bob, I hope publishers keep sending you books so that you can remain wealthy on your pension. Because I mean, if you have to feed your addiction all by yourself, then I don't know, you might have to start becoming a greeter at Target or something. So,
yeah, that's right. That does help. Has helped my book budget. I can go out to McDonald's because I don't have to buy that $50 book that that the publisher sent me.
Well, that's good. Well, Bob, I appreciate the conversation. For those that are interested, your latest book is Called to Bless, Finding Hope by Reclaiming Our Spiritual Roots. And people can find your book reviews every week at wordandway.org or at bobcornwall.com. So thanks, Bob, for joining us and giving us some time.
I appreciate the opportunity to share my thoughts. Thanks, Brian.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordandway.org. Thanks for listening.